I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Laura Carstensen. She is a professor of psychology at Stanford University and the founding director of the Stanford Center on Longevity and the author of A Long Bright Future, an Action Plan for a Lifetime of Happiness, Health, and Financial Security. Welcome, Dr. Carstensen.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, the Stanford Center for Longevity, can you tell us a little bit about its work?
Yes. It's a center that was started at Stanford a little over 3 years ago. And our aim is to improve the course of human aging through science and technology. We argue that to the extent that people arrive at old age mentally sharp, physically fit, and financially secure, individuals and societies will thrive.
That's...
So our response to concerns about aging is to say we can alter the course of aging, and in doing so, we'll eliminate or circumvent most of those concerns.
Now, one of the things that I'm sure many people hear about aging is that our life expectancy has gone has risen by 30 years over the last 100 years. That's not entirely true, though, is it? Because most of that is a kind of an actuarial trick because of the decline of infant mortality and childhood mortality. But we have, in fact, had an increase, even when you take that into account, in overall life expectancy over the last 100 or so years.
Right. Generally, when people say life expectancy, they tacitly mean life expectancy at birth. And you're correct. That's what has increased by 30 years. Life expectancy can be computed at any age, and that increases less as you go up. So you could calculate life expectancy at 65, for example. And life expectancy at 65 has also gone up, and it continues to go up. So we've been seeing an increase of about 3 months every year for the past several years in life expectancy at 65. So we are still continuing to see gains. But if you look at the 30 years that you just referred to, a big hunk of that, as you say, came from saving the lives of the youngest among us, and that's what made that number look so big.
Now, it's also true, isn't it, that if we went back, say, to the 1970s, that actuarial expectations about longevity were that there would be a flattening out, a plateauing. Mm-hmm. Very few people were projecting the kind of continually accelerating lengthening of the life that we've seen. And as a consequence, a lot of models like Social Security and Medicare expenditure models have had to be continually revised.
Right. And there was a recent report by J. Olshansky, Jack Rowe, and Dana Goldman suggesting that even the most current ones are underestimating the length of time that people will live. You're exactly right. There was a really interesting kind of debate going on, still is, between biologists and demographers, because biologists tend to say that there's a biological cap on life expectancy, and you know we can only live so long. And what the demographers for years now have been arguing is, well, that may be, but we don't see any evidence of it. If you just track, you know, you just chart how long people have been living over time, it's just if the trend continues to go up. So we don't know how long people can live, of course, lifespan, which is a very different concept than life expectancy.
The other thing that seems to have been happening is that our expectations about what senior years are supposed to be like have been shifting. And at the same time, the rate of senior disability, probably both as cause and consequence, has been shifting. In other words, seniors are a lot more able physically and mentally than they have been in the past.
This is probably the best news for societies. Again, if we go, you know, go back to the 1980s, scientists were really concerned that what was going to happen was we would increase the length of time that people lived, but not reduce the length of infirmity happily, what has come to pass is that that length of infirmity has remained relatively constant, so it's just being pushed out. If you compare 60-year-olds, for example, today to 60-year-olds in 1960, they're much healthier. So this is really good news.
When I first got involved in bioethics back in the late 1980s, I was at first quite a fan of being a hard-nosed utilitarian, first quite a fan of folks who argued for, like what was the guy, the governor of Colorado, who argued that we should have strict age rationing limits. Lamb, mm-hmm. Governor Lamb, mm-hmm. argued at the time that we should have strict rationing limits on medical resources for seniors. Mm-hmm. And over the last 20 years, everything's been turned on its head because when you look at, what I found was when you looked at those last year of life in Medicare actuarial studies, it's true that a lot of resources get spent, but you can never predict when someone's exactly. last year is. So right. if we knew that it was someone's last year, then we could say, yeah, well, maybe we shouldn't spend so much, but you can never predict. So, mm-hmm. And we just keep living longer and longer. So I think there are a lot of people's assumptions about whether we should be spending and what kinds of resources we should be spending in the senior years have been shifting around.
Yeah, I think I'm glad that I don't hear those debates as frequently as I used to hear them. You know, when people used to talk openly about rationing by age, and still do to some extent, but as you say, it's not quite as common a conversation. You know, to say, you know, that a 75-year-old goes into the emergency room and needs some kind of, you know, major sort of intervention and say, oh, no, 75, we're not going to do it, begins to say that we're going to evaluate the value of a life based on how much time that person has left. And if you take that argument and you start to play it out, there are all sorts of very, very uncomfortable kinds of arguments that would follow, like, women live on average longer than men, so wouldn't we save the life of a 75-year-old woman but not a 75-year-old man? And then you could carry it even further and say, well, you know, African-American life expectancy isn't as long as European-American life expectancy in the United States. Would we then say, well, we should have different rules there, too? So I think when you start to use a number like, and clearly that would be, you know, horrific, right? When you start to use numbers about what we think might be left in life as a value, it's problematic on all sorts of counts, I believe.
In other words, you're saying you could go into the hospital and you say, well, this white woman should get the penicillin, but this black man should not because right. he's just going to die anyway. And
exactly.
she's not.
That would be, that's the logical, you know, that's where you would take that argument logically, and that's ridiculous, right?
Right. Now, you start your book with five myths about aging, and one of them we've already addressed, which is the common assumption that being old is a terrible condition to be in. And I just finished teaching a course about happiness, and we looked extensively at one of these questions, which is how happy seniors are. On the one hand, being senior does mean that you have more diseases and more disability in general, and as a consequence, that's not pleasant. But seniors tend to be more calm, and they have more contentment about their life, and they tend to feel like their life is happier in that respect than younger people. And so it kind of turns on our head these notions about what happiness means, because older people are happier in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I think it's one of the most surprising findings about human aging is that when people lose the very things that we believe as a society make people happy, you know, power and youth and attractiveness and physical functioning, if anything, they appear to be happier. So what does that mean about happiness? I agree. I think that's an interesting question.
Now, your second myth is DNA is destiny.
Is not.
Is not destiny, right? The myth is that DNA...
Or yes, this part would be, yes. I'm sorry, yes.
Right. So unpack that for us.
An awful lot of people live their lives believing that somehow inside them is a blueprint for the rest of their life and how they're going to live and how healthy they'll be and how they're going to die, and that there's not all that much that they can do about it. Another version of that same kind of story is, well, everybody dies, which is absolutely true. So, you know, it's just a question of from what and when. And those kinds of beliefs or those kinds of assumptions get people in a lot of trouble as they grow older because to some extent, it's true, but to a larger extent, it's not true, and it's really about the quality of your life. So the older people get, the more lifestyle predicts length of life than biology. So there are some genetic disorders that tend to kill people relatively early in life, and there's relatively little they can do about it. Huntington's disease, for example. But if for the vast majority of people, the more common killers are chronic diseases, heart disease, cancers, and those are very much affected by lifestyle, and as I say, increasingly more so as people get older. So it's very dangerous to think, if you're interested in a healthy, long life, that there's not a lot you can do about that.
Well, both of my parents died relatively young from cancer, and that was something that certainly weighed on my mind, you know, wondering if I was not going to reach my 60s because of cancer. But as you say, those are very poor predictors, we understand nowadays.
Very poor predictors. And of course, it varies by cancer. Take lung cancer, for example. If you don't smoke, it's very unlikely you're going to die from lung cancer, or you're going to at least a primary lung cancer. So there are clear environmental inputs into the cancer process.
Now, as the common wisdom was that when we enacted Social Security, the majority of people did not live past 65. Is that true, or is that just a myth? Back in the 1930s, there was the actuarial table.
Yeah, the majority
against,
of people did not.
Did not right. live past 65. Okay, so
right.
that's true. And but today, of course, the vast majority do.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of people who live to 65 are in far better physical and mental shape and able to do one kind of white-collar service occupation or another. So the notion that everybody should be retiring at 65 may be a social convention, but it's not a social necessity the way that it was back in the 1930s. And that's one of the big things that we're going to have to grapple with. You say in the book, and many people have been trying to say in public policy with not very much effect so far.
Right.
So how are we going to change that conversation? Whenever there's a discussion about extending retirement ages or modifying pension plans in Europe and the United States, people get beat up for that.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest problem is that we generally start those conversations with discussions of Social Security and budgets, when I believe they should be about quality of life and what gives people satisfaction and meaning, and what does an ideal life look like. The problem when you start talking about Social Security and budgets is that it immediately, when you say people need to work longer, is that you're saying we're going to take something away from you. And you know, people are pretty loss averse. They don't like it when conversations by politicians are saying we're going to not give you something that we told you we were going to give you. So I think it's the starting point has been problematic. Instead, I believe we really have this incredible, incredible, unprecedented opportunity to redesign work life. That is, to rethink how people should work, could work, will work, when life expectancy is somewhere in the, you know, between 90 and 100, what would models look like? And, you know, think about it just for a second. Would the best model look like one where you work really hard from, say, 20 to 65? I mean, really hard. And then you retire and do nothing and have the government support you for 35 years. You know, there are very few people who, if you know, again, forget about budgets here for a minute. Just say, is that the way people would like to live and to work? And most people don't like that model, and that's our model currently. If instead we could say, well, what let's stretch out work and start to think about models where people might work part-time, say from 20 to 40 when they're relatively young, they could travel, they could start their families, both mothers and fathers could spend time with their children gradually. I'm not saying don't work during those times, but maybe work part-time, three-quarters time. And then gradually enter the workforce full-time and say work full-time between 40 and 80, and I did say 80, and then start to gradually retire, fade out, you know, flexibly work, and retire between, say, 80 and 85, or, you know, even 80 to 90. Those are models where, you know, you really could begin to generate, I think, some interesting discussion about what that kind of work life would look like, and would it improve quality of life, not just for old people, but for people of all ages.
I'm totally on board with your pointing out that this can't be just a discussion of forcing seniors to work more, but it has to be a discussion of changing our whole approach to the life course, because one of the things that's also going to be happening in the next 20, 30 years that's already underway is the automation and continual automation of manual and white-collar work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be reducing the number of jobs available for everybody in the economy. In fact, we peaked in the late 1990s in terms of the percentage of the population who were in the workforce, and it's been steadily falling since then. And so the notion that seniors are going to be healthy and can't be on the dole for 40 years is true, but simply saying, well, we're going to force them into the workforce without rethinking everything is just doesn't make sense either. We have to rethink a continual kind of cycle of work and sabbatical and part-time labor and shared work all across the board.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if you think about it, if you were, instead of people saying, we're going to cut your Social Security benefits, they started to say, we're going to reduce the strain of work life throughout your life. You know, that's a way to start a productive conversation.
Now, J. Olshansky, you mentioned earlier, he's one of the principal aging demographers who's been looking at these questions. And in the early part of this decade, he was quite a critic, along with many other people involved in aging, of anti-aging nostrums and life extension firms. But in more recent years, he's been singing a different tune about the potential benefits of longevity medicine and anti-aging medicine, which he has dubbed, and he and others have dubbed, the longevity dividend, the notion that if we could figure out therapies that would slow down the aging process and extend the number of healthy years at the end of life, that it would have all these ripple benefits across the economy. Are I presume you're on board with that general idea.
Well, I'm on board with both of Jay's arguments. And I don't see him so much as changing his tune as clarifying what is meant. So he and a number of other scholars issued a statement about anti-aging products. And I don't think any of them would change their tune at this point in time. What they said is that there are no products on the market at this point in time that will slow or reduce the aging process. And it was really aimed at all of these kind of snake oil salesmen who are out there trying to sell you, you know, take this and take that, and it's going to slow aging, and it's going to do this and that. There isn't anything like that known right now on the market. That's a very different thing than saying, can we improve health so that added years are healthy years? That isn't necessarily saying we're going to slow some fundamental biological process of aging, although, you know, it's possible that would happen at some point in time, although there's nothing right now on the market that will do it. And but it's much more about function and curing diseases and so on, so that people wouldn't have chronic diseases that they currently have when they're old.
Well, I presume you're taking your resveratrol.
I tried resveratrol after talking with some of the scientists who are doing work with it. And what they were saying is, of course, there's no clinical evidence for its efficacy in humans at all. But what I heard from some friends of friends is, you know, all the people in these labs, you know, the graduate students are all taking it.
Right.
So it was affecting people enough watching those animals that they were interested in it. My personal idea about all these things, from, you know, folic acid to, you know, various kinds of things that people could take, is if it is a do no harm kind of approach. If it's something that's not going to hurt you, you might try it.
Hard to poison yourself with fish oil.
I'm sorry?
Hard to poison yourself with fish oil.
Exactly. So if it makes you feel better, you know, do it. But do it in understanding that, you know, it's in all likelihood you're going to increase the quality of your urine more than the years of your life.
Right. Now, you have a pretty pessimistic chapter called What Might Go Wrong, which, given the difficult political obstacles that making the kind of changes you propose we should be making face, there's quite a few things that could keep us derailed. The persistence of poverty, the persistence of chronic illness, the growth of obesity, et cetera. So would you say that your perspective is on the whole optimistic or pessimistic?
Oh, I'm constantly called an optimist by my friends and colleagues. I do believe entirely, completely, that we have been given the greatest gift that has ever been given to humans in the history of humankind, and that is the prospect of living twice as long as our ancestors did. So we have added years. We've got the potential of doing something extraordinary, really, really significantly improving quality of life. But we haven't been handed this as a finished product. I mean, what we've been given is the opportunity. But we need to apply science and technology and culture change in a serious, significant way in order to realize those gains. A lot can go wrong. And we, by understanding and looking at what can go wrong, I think it helps us understand what we need to do now, what the problems are that need to be solved.
One of the issues that I've looked at in the past, I worked on an ethics of home care for seniors project back 15 years ago and have continued to follow that field because I just don't think hospitals are, you know, functional way to deliver health care. And we have all these new tools of the kind of hospitalization of the home, the extension of medical monitoring and two-way telecommunications between healthcare providers and patients in the home. Do you see that as one of the big steps forward for what it means to be a senior in the United States? Because we just won't have to have the kind of nursing structures and hospital structures that we currently do.
Yes, I think we will and need to get to that point where we don't have a need for, certainly for moving older adults into residences designed for older people and vulnerabilities. We need to create communities in which people can live and thrive throughout their lives. So to the extent that we can redesign neighborhoods, redesign homes so that they're easily modified when people need assistance, so that it would be relatively inexpensive to monitor people in some way to, say, find out if they fell or if they haven't moved in the last, you know, 6 hours, you might be worried. We would be able to make invisible the kinds of monitoring and healthcare systems that would really improve quality of life and keep people in their own homes. I mean, I think that should be the ultimate aim.
Because that kind of empowerment, I mean, one of the constant observations is that the degree to which seniors lose a sense of self-determination by being put into a nursing home or even within the nursing context, they also lose their own capacity to keep themselves alive. I mean, there seems to be this kind of mind-body connection between a sense of personal control and being able to live longer.
I think there's really something to that. From a societal perspective, we need to care about the elderly, but I'm holding out that that older populations are going to save us all. I mean, I think, you know, from the other perspective, the other side of this is we need older people to be engaged in families and communities and neighborhoods and workplaces because we need them. We need people who know a lot, who have an incredible amount of experience to contribute. And so, again, by building workplaces and neighborhoods that can tap the expertise of older adults, we will all benefit. It won't just be a question of, can we do something nice for the old folks?
So I assume you're not a big fan of the notion of Sun City, Lizard Farms, retirement communities that segregate folks out of the regular community.
Yeah, you know, I'm not. I am all for, let me say, I'm all for individual choice. So I think people should make their own decisions. And if there's some people who want to go live together with a bunch of older people, that's just fine if that's their choice. And I would support that fully. So let me, you know, make that clear. But that said, do I believe that should be the model for aging societies? Absolutely not. I mean, I think it's a one where we all lose and instead of gain. And again, I think if we just give people choice, most older people will remain involved in their communities and interact with people of multiple generations and stay engaged if they had that choice.
And my final question, I guess, is back to the pessimism theme. We seem to have lost an opportunity in the recent healthcare reform debate to address long-term care. Do you think we'll get back around to that in a couple of years? It seems inescapable that eventually we might have to figure out a better way to finance long-term care.
Long-term care is a enormous, is it a gorilla in the room? that people aren't talking as much about as they need to talk about. And it really is. It's long-term care and it's end-of-life care, as you mentioned earlier, that is costing so much money to the society. So we do need to address those things. I believe very much that science and technology can help to address them, certainly long-term care. Technology could go a long way toward keeping people in their own homes throughout their lives. So that's one positive there. We need to start talking about it. The most optimistic take I have on the current discussions about reform is that it'll be a first step toward many steps that we need to take to really create a system in this country that is effective and ethical and accessible and high quality.
I've been speaking with Dr. Laura Carstensen about her book, A Long, Bright Future. She is the founding director of the Stanford Center of Longevity and a professor of psychology there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.